Yesterday, we were discussing a very important subject, which every student of yoga should remember. How the two types of perception about which Sage Patanjali tells us some very important aspects. Tell upon not only your personal and social life, but our efforts towards spiritual perfection. The determinate aspects of psychological experience I have been touched upon briefly yesterday as consisting of principally self-affirmation, egoism, which projects itself as love and hatred. Also, we had occasion to go a little deep into the mystery of love and hatred as to why they arise at all. This is the type of life that generally the individual lives in the world. Getting identified with these psychological processes to such an extent that one cannot know that one is so involved. The worst thing for a person would be to get involved in something and not know that it has happened. Because in such a case, observation, experiment and analysis would not be possible. There should be some sort of a possibility for objective observation by a state of mind which will act as a witness of these conditions of observation. But these conditions to be observed get identified with the witnessing consciousness itself. Then observation is not possible. So self-analysis is a very difficult process. It is a difficult process because in the self which is to be analyzed, the subject and object cannot be distinguished. And we are used only to those types of analysis, kinds of analysis, where the object of observation stands outside the subject of investigation. Self-investigation is difficult merely for this reason. You cannot know yourself, analyze yourself, study yourself, examine yourself or treat yourself. For obvious reasons. Now, why this situation has arisen? Why is this vehement affirmation of the ego, assertion of the mind in respect of a particular condition which is passing, transitory, phenomenal? The attachment of the mind to a particular condition is the principle of egoism. And why does it happen? Why does it breed the further problems of like, dislike, love of physical life, individual life and fear of death, etc.? This happens because of a background which is still deeper than this particular psychological involvement. The very belief in the reality of externals is the cause for this calamity. Because the moment you have a conviction that the object of perception is real, you have to develop a real attitude towards it. The perception of the object as something real is the beginning of the trouble. Then the trouble intensifies itself as a compulsive activity towards the development of an attitude towards that object. The precondition of this attitude is egoism. So to give you a successive stage of the series of the successive stages of this development, first there is a perception of the object, such as a tree, for example, in front. I perceive an object in front of me, such as a tree, and I am convinced that it is a real tree. The tree is really there. It is not an unreal perception. The existence of the tree is real. It is really there outside me. The outsidedness of the tree is also real. The tree is real, its externality to me is real. And therefore, I am now compelled to develop a real attitude towards it. Now comes the second problem. What is this real attitude that I have to develop towards it? The force that urges this real attitude towards the object is egoism. It is the breeding ground for the impulsive power which drives the consciousness out towards that object which has been regarded as real. It is not possible to merely perceive an object and have no attitude towards it. Because the very consciousness of an object is the demand of the object to be recognized in a certain manner. And this recognition is called attitude. Therefore, we have to find out now what is the reason for this perception of the object itself. You know, we are going from the lower stage to the higher stage. From the immediate experience of a concrete trouble to the causes thereof. We have a complex problem in the form of like and dislike for objects. And we want to maintain this condition of like and dislike, therefore there is love of life and fear of death. Which of course requires the affirmation of the individual subject maintaining this attitude. And now we have arrived at the stage where we understand the reason behind all this psychological activity is the perception of an object as a real something external to oneself. Why do we perceive the object? We are not deliberately or of our own accord perceiving the object. Here also we are forced. Ultimately you will find that everything that you do is under a compulsion. Though people parade under the notion that they are free people and they can do whatever they want, it is not so. There is no free person in this world. Everybody is a slave of an urge, a force, a compulsion that is at the back of all these psychological activities. Just as you cannot see your own back, you cannot see the existence of these forces. They are behind. The perception of an object is caused by a subtle activity that has taken place in the cosmos itself. We have to go back to the Upanishads and texts which are akin in nature. The human mind is not made in such a way as to be able to comprehend what has happened ultimately. This is what they call the cosmological analysis of human experience. Why do you exist at all as an individual? And then be compelled to perceive objects and then have to undergo all this tragedy and suffering of attitudes, positive, negative, etc. This is a mystery for the human intellect. While you may be able to understand and explain what things are like in the world, you will not be able to explain yourself. Why you are what you are? Can you explain why you are what you are? I am what I am, that's all. It has no reason behind it. But there is a reason, which is the reason behind the reason itself. Here we go back to a condition beyond human intellect. Great masters like Acharya Shankara, Ramanuja, etc. tell us that here we land in a realm where intellect should not interfere. The intellect has a boundary and beyond that boundary it is useless. Now I am touching upon a realm where intellect will not work and it is not supposed to work at all, because this is a cosmic question and intellect is made in such a way that it cannot understand cosmic relationships. The reason is that intellect is an individualized endowment. It is not a cosmic principle. It is a function of the individual psychological principle. This is what we call the intellect. And therefore it will work only in terms of the affirmation of individuality. The intellect will always take for granted that the individual exists. But now we are trying to find out why the individual exists at all. So you know why the intellect will not work here. The intellect cannot work here because of the simple reason that you are trying to find out the cause of the intellect itself. So intellect fails, as it has to fail. Here we go to a realm where the revelations of the ancient masters, which are embodied in the sacred scriptures, become our guide. Otherwise we shall be blind, we will know nothing. The great masters who are the gurus of mankind, who had plumbed the depths of being and had vision of the cosmic mystery, tell us something which the intellect cannot explain inductively, logically or scientifically. Your individual existence is caused by something which is prior to the manifestation of individuality, and therefore let not the individual intellect interfere with this subject. The masters whose records we have, for example, in such scriptures as the Upanishads, tell us that there is a cosmic mystery behind this operation of individuality, namely the diversification of the cosmic principle. You cannot ask as to why it happened, because the intellect is interfering here. You are asking the reason why the intellect is there at all and why individuality is there at all. That question cannot be asked, because this intellect is an effect of individuality and now we are trying to find out the cause thereof. Unbridled intellect is an obstacle, says Shankara in his commentary on the Brahma Sutras. Because the intellect will insist that there is diversity. it will oblige you to accept that individuality is real, objects are real, your relationships to them must be real, and so on and so forth. So you should not take the advice of this intellect hereafter. The mystery of cosmic manifestation, which is the diversification of the cosmic principle, is regarded as the controlling principle behind the existence and the function of the individual. Nowadays, our scientists also have conjectured the possibility of the universe having been once upon a time constituted in such a way as a sort of a cosmic atom. One scientist said the whole cosmos was like an atom. By an atom he means an indivisible something. The whole universe originally was like an atom, and that atom split into two parts. This is mentioned in the Manusmriti also, prior to the declaration of this scientist. In the first chapter of the Manusmriti, you will find the process of creation described. And instead of atom, Manu says anda. It was like an egg. Well, the scientist says an atom. It is not an egg looking like an egg, which split into two parts. This original split of the atom into two parts is the cause of all our problems today. And it is going on splitting and splitting. 2 became 4, 4 became 8, 8 became 16 and umpteen and million fold and uncountable in number. These little split parts are the individuals. You, I, everybody included. We are struggling to become the atom once again. Something unnatural has happened to us. While the physical scientist thinks that the atom has really split into a million fold parts, the sages tell us that really it has not split itself like that. It is only an appearance, really there is no split. Because if it has really split, you cannot go back into the original. Just as it is very difficult to convert curd into milk once it has become curd. It is finished. But that is not the case. If that had happened, there would be no urge of the part to go back to the whole. If you have really been cut off, finished, the matter is over. Why are you urging back to unite yourself with the whole? That means a real split has not taken place. A kind of mysterious bifurcation has taken place. To put it in modern psychological term, a kind of schizophrenia cosmically taking place. In schizophrenia, the person does not become split, but looks like split personality. In this condition, which sometimes is compared to a dream split of consciousness, a real isolation does not take place. This is another analogy. Your personality splits itself into the observer and the observed world in dream. But are you really split? No. Otherwise you would not wake up as a whole individual. The perception of real objects in dream by a real subject dreaming and a real attitude of like, dislike, etc., which that subject projects towards the object, all this drama looking very, very real is not truly real. Because if that had really taken place, there would be no waking up of the individuality, wholeness of consciousness. So this is explained only as a mystery beyond human comprehension. This universal condition which has ramified itself as if in dream into the individual segments is the cause for the affirmation of individuality and the perception of objects and the likes and dislikes and the sorrows of this world. Our very sorrow is due to our loss of identity with the cosmic. Otherwise there would be no sorrow in this world. We are suffering due to an agony felt on account of our isolation from that cosmic of which we are a part. So, the philosophical and spiritual advice in this context is that the mystery of life cannot be explained and the sorrow of life cannot be obviated unless the original cause is discovered and it is dealt with in a manner which is requisite. This requisite manner of dealing with the ultimate question is yoga. As I mentioned earlier, yoga is a gradual process of identification of the part with the whole. Now, analogically speaking, if the one has become two and two has become four, four has become etc., etc., so that we are today what we are in this condition, the reverse process of returning to the original unity would be by a successive recession of the very same process, stage by stage, missing not a single link. And these are the stages of yoga. The steps in yoga or the stages of knowledge are the process of the recession of the effect into the cause. The condition of the effect in which one is, A or B or X, Y, Z. So you have to find out your present condition. And from that condition of yours, you must retrace your steps back. Not suddenly to the topmost unity, but to the immediately above condition. The step that is next to you, the condition above you, the stage is ahead of you, is your goal for the present or the time being, with which one has to get united in meditation, in yoga. And that second step would be the effect of a further stage ahead and so on and so forth until the final unity is achieved. So it would be not judicious on the part of any individual to vehemently assert that the physical perceptions of the world are all in all. The materialist conception is therefore not correct, because this conception arises on account of a miscalculated attitude towards everything. This is the reason why in the practice of yoga, expert guidance is called for, because you are dealing with matters which are super intellectual, super rational. Here, your own understanding is of not much use, nor books are of any use, because you are treading on dangerous grounds, which the mind has not seen and cannot contemplate. Ascharyavat pashyati kashchidenam. You all a wonder, says the scripture. Ascharyavakta kushalosya shrota. This is a mystery, a wonder. It is a wonder because it is not capable of intellectually being analyzed. The scripture proclaims that the subject is a great mystery, great wonder and marvel, and one who teaches it is also a marvel, ascharyavakta, and one who receives this knowledge, understands it, the disciple, this disciple also is a wonder indeed. Because though the broadcasting station is powerful, the receiver set also was equally powerful to receive the message. A bamboo stick will not receive the message of a BBC. So the disciple also is a wonder to receive this mysterious knowledge, as the teacher himself a wonder, and the subject is a marvel by itself. So comes the need to be cautious in the adjustment of the mind and the judgment of values in life. The sutras of Patanjali I refer to give only a hint and do not enter into details. The hint being that the vrittis or the modifications of the mind of a twofold character, which I translated as determinate and indeterminate, have to be gradually controlled. And this control of the vrittis or the modifications of the mind is regarded as yoga. Yoga chitta vritti nirodha. Yoga is the control of the modifications of the stuff of the mind, the very substance of psychological action. Not merely the external modifications, but the very stuff of it, the very root of it has to be controlled. And this is done by successive stages. We always to move from the effect to the cause in the manner indicated in this analysis that we have made. Ultimately it comes to this, that our perceptions are our problems, and they become a problem because we pass judgments on these perceptions. Mere perceptions as they are, let alone to themselves, would be a different matter altogether. But we do not simply perceive an object and keep quiet. The moment we perceive something, we pass a judgment on that. Oh, this is something. This is a snake. This is a perception. Oh, it is dangerous. This is a judgment. I have to run away from it. Another judgment. This is a mango. That is one judgment. Very sweet. Second judgment. I must eat it. Third judgment. So you go on passing judgments after judgments of various complex characters on an object of perception. So judgments become subsequent effects of the perception of an object. Now, perceptions are of two kinds, real perceptions and unreal perceptions. When we perceive an object in the world, like a tree, it appears to be real. You cannot say it is unreal. Why is it real? What is the definition of reality? This is another very interesting philosophical subject. How do you know that any object is real? Now, if you are asked, how do you define reality? What do you mean by real? What is your idea? If you are asked to define reality, define the character of anything being real, you will find it is difficult to define it. If I project my fingers and attempt at touching it, I must have a sensation of touch. Then it is real, isn't it? The sensation of touch should say there is a hard object. Then I say it is real. So is this a definition of reality? So you want only a sensation of hardness. The moment that sensation comes, it is real. And it has to be corroborated by the eyes. They must also say, yes, we are seeing a shape. The eyes can see only a shape. But how do you know that the shape is real? The fingers will tell, we are seeing a solidity, feeling a solidity, hardness, concreteness. And if it has a smell and a taste, etc., then it becomes real. Okay, we have passed judgment, it is real. So the nose should smell, the fingers should feel the concreteness and solidity, the eye should see a shape, etc., then the thing is real. Is this a definition? This is a dangerous definition. But you cannot have another definition. The reason behind your feeling a solidity, concreteness, hardness, etc. of an object and a shape perceived by the eyes is because the condition of the senses which perceive and that of the mind behind the senses are on the same level as the constitution of the object. That is why we can see this world and not the heavens, for example. You cannot say that heavens do not exist. But why don't you see them? Because the constitution of the objects of the heaven is subtler than, less dense than the constitution of our present individuality. The two are not commensurate with each other. Or you can give a more concrete example. Why don't you hear the music of the radio through the ears? Somebody must be singing through the radio now, but the transistor will tell you it is there, but your ears are deaf. They can't hear anything. Because the constitution, the structure, the frequency, the wavelength of the electrical message that is sent by the broadcasting station is subtler than the constitution, the structure of the eardrum. The eardrum is not possible to catch it because it is gross. But if you talk, I can hear. Because your sound, the sound that you make by talking is of the same level or degree of density as the capacity of the eardrum. Your sound I can hear, but the radio waves, music or the message I cannot hear. The reason is dissimilarity of structure, of frequency or wavelength or density of structure. So the world need not be real merely because of the fact that we are seeing it. It only shows that we are as much fools as the things are. We are in the same level or degree of reality as the atmosphere around us. This is not a great proof for the reality of the world. If I agree with you, it does not mean that our agreement is based on any judicious judgment. Suppose you have an opinion and I agree with that opinion. It does not mean that the opinion is correct. Merely because I agree with you, it need not be correct. It shows that my way of thinking is similar to your way of thinking. That is all. That does not mean that it is correct opinion. A third person may not agree with it. So merely because our mental makeup and sensory constitution agree with the structure of things outside does not mean that the world exists or it is real. It only says that we are on the same level. That's all. Here is a caution to us that we have to be on our guard in our attachment to things and our taking them for ultimate realities, from which we have to withdraw ourselves into higher, more judicious judgments for the purpose of higher unity. Hari Om Tat Sat.